thank you for tuning in to the Dead TV Podcast, a podcast dedicated to canceled television shows in the horror, science fiction, fantasy genre. I am your host, Dr. Chris.
And I'm Mr. Seneca.
And tonight's episode is the sixth episode of the TV series Constantine, which was canceled on NBC a couple years ago. Thank you for joining us. Mr. Seneca has the episode synopsis for this episode of Constantine.
Okay, today's episode is Rage of Caliban, originally aired on November 28th, 2014. When a young boy is taken over by a malevolent spirit, John must put aside his misgivings over exorcising a child and convince the parents that their boy is not all that he seems. Dun dun dun.
And the boy in this episode, want to point out right in the beginning, the actor who plays him also has played many other screwed up children, if you will, in a way. He is currently on the TV series The Strain, and last season ended with him igniting an atomic bomb.
Well, you know, this episode in particular had a very Omen-ish feel because of his acting. And he does a really good, like, sociopathic, deadpan acting. And that really brings about, like, the whole Omen exorcist type of vibe. You know, overall, I didn't really like this one as much as the previous episode, the Dance Voodoo.
Mm-hmm.
But it's all right. It's all right. I did read, however, that this was supposed to be episode 2, and instead they moved it to episode 6.
Oh, I wonder what the reason for that was.
I don't know, but it is a Halloween episode, so they aired The Darkness Beneath on Halloween.
Okay, so yeah, that's right. It is Halloween throughout this episode.
Yeah, and Zed is not in it. So, you know, that's another hint that this was supposed to be an episode a little bit, you know, more into the beginning of the series versus the middle of the series.
Yeah, where Zed is just, like, completely disappears.
Yeah, yeah. I think they put a line in that she's at an art class, just kind of, you know, stuffed it in there, you know, to tie it in with the next episode.
Wah, wah.
Yeah, blessed are the damned, but, yeah, this episode is a very kind of straightforward exorcism, you know, mystery type of story.
I don't like the sound of that, they just, like, redo episodes however they damn well please.
Yeah, I mean, you know, out of all the episodes, I particularly didn't like this one as much.
Mm-hmm.
It just didn't feel like the emphasis on the darkness, growing darkness, was in equal balance in proportion to how it has been growing throughout the series. And so that could be the element of this episode 2 being moved to episode 6. Like, Manny is in it, and again, why? He doesn't really do anything, again, in this episode. But there were some good points, so we're going to talk about those.
Yeah, the actor I was talking about, his name is Max Charles, and he has a long career in Hollywood already. He's the voice of Sherman in Mr. Peabody and Sherman, the movie, as well as the 46 episodes of the current animated series.
Wow.
Yeah.
Very prolific kid actor there.
Yeah, and again, he plays Zach Goodweather on The Strain, the vampire TV series currently on FX, which returns for its final season this fall.
Nice. So the episode opens up with, you know, kind of that whole, we're going to take a look at the crime and then we go to the vault type of format here. So the first set of victims, there's a struggle and a child is revealed, Emily, you know, the first kind of possessed person that we see in this episode. In this episode they do a very cool effect where they kind of black out her eyes. You know, anyone, you know, that this demon possesses, or not demon, but anything that this entity possesses, blacks out the eyes when their powers are activated.
Mm-hmm.
Gives that demon-ish type of feel to it. I kind of like that effect. But, you know, she explodes a coffee cup because people start arguing, whatnot. Cut to logo.
That black eye effect demon thing has been used many a times in TV series Supernatural.
Yeah, yeah. And those contact lenses, you really have to get specialty lenses ordered for those, because the optometrist, when they measure your eyes, actually have to measure your whole eyeball, because those are sclera lenses. And I tried to get some for a costume quite a number of years ago, and my eyes are just too small that they don't make them that small, unfortunately.
Aren't all eyeballs kind of like the same size when you're an adult? No?
Actually, no. Apparently, no. I have astigmatism, and I couldn't get the scleral lenses. Scleral lenses, overall, when you wear them, you have very, very limited sight. You know, they are meant to, you know, block out your real vision for the most part. But the shape of your eyeball itself will determine your ability to actually wear them. So because I have astigmatism, my eyes are kind of shaped football-like, and scleral lenses are meant for a little bit more rounder eyeball, so I could not get them.
After the girl displays her supernatural powers, John is seen shacking up with a girl whose boyfriend's on the way to kick his ass.
Yeah, yeah. This was actually the first time that in the series that we actually see John getting it on, you know? It's proof that he actually does have sex. In the Hellblazer comics, though, John Constantine is actually bisexual.
I've heard that.
Yeah, they're not going to touch on it in the series, but...
No, of course not. This is NBC.
Yeah, of course, yeah. But Hellblazer 51, there's just a one panel that says, girlfriends, the odd boyfriend, they all have a nasty habit of walking out on me. So, you know, he is a hero-ish type person and bisexual, which is very odd in comics and media. But, there is portions of comics in the Hellblazer where you do see him coming out of a bedroom window. I tried to track them down because I know I saw them, I know I read them, but I could not. Just like little brief frames of him like leaving the scene of a one-night stand through the window. But I thought that was the yum moment of the entire episode because that's... kind of sexy.
I've never have myself had to leave the scene of a crime through a window after a one-night stand, thankfully.
Neither have I.
No.
Neither have I.
No. No. Closest I had to come was, like, out the back door. My girlfriend at the time last year, his father was coming over to fix something at her place. And she's like, you need to leave this way because dad's coming up this way. And I'm not explaining this, so go.
I've hidden people in my room, when I was
a teenage
of age,
girl.
But hidden people, but no, I've never had to leave out a back way or whatnot, or none of my partners had to leave out a back way. I just kind of had to hide them under the bed.
Now, when Chaz makes John breakfast back at the bunker, every time I see somebody making somebody food so desperately that they need it, I crave it too. It happened when I was watching like V for Vendetta. V makes the girl, Natalie Portman's character, this breakfast toast thing with an egg cracked in the middle of it.
Yeah, the egg in a basket.
The egg in a basket. Every time I see that, I'm always like, oh, I want egg in a basket right now. So...
Did you hear the music that was playing in the background of that scene?
No, what was it?
That is a Tom Waits song called Sea of Love. Yeah, Tom Waits. You don't really hear him in a lot of, popular television shows, but he's a good artist, I think.
Once upon a time on the CW at the end of every episode, or the WB, like on the they would have like an album played, and before the credits, when they came back from commercial from the final scene, they would be like, music from this episode came from this artist right here, buy their album at this site or on this site.
I mean, I actually like that because sometimes you hear something on a show and you're like, what is that? That's so good.
Yeah.
And then you just have to scour the internet trying to find it.
Now, I think they did that a lot with the CW or the WB when they first started, with a lot of independent people putting their music in episodes to give them some notoriety. Because a lot of times it was definitely a few musicians I had never heard of.
Yeah, I remember that. And I always found it a handy tool.
But we're going to skip over Manny's Darkness Rising thing because that you'd already mentioned that. And honestly, that he doesn't really serve any purpose in this until the upcoming two-parter episode, which we'll get to in a few weeks. John lights something up. What is that he lights up?
He actually lights up a text written in Hebrew.
That's right. Okay.
According to the script, it's actually written in Hebrew. I couldn't get such a good look at it. What he actually says is in Mayan. It's actually a Yucateco. It's a Zimbatic Kajul Akbin Ka Ak Ahabu. And that, I looked up each individual word there. You know, it took me a little bit of time. But I am roughly translating this as, see with fire, go to recent night, what's come to happen.
By the way, the but before we left the bunker, Chaz decided he was going to be playing with a what John calls the Sword of Night. And it compels him to say the truth. The Sword of Night was first seen in Showcase number 82 in 1969. Showcase comic books were a kind of miscellaneous various stories, usually depicting the Flash, but also where DC would drop in other very rarely known characters to get some spotlight on them, like Deadman or others.
Yeah, so the Sword of Night is owned by the Nightmaster, which I think currently is still Jim Rook, which is the former lead singer of the Electrics, according to his timeline. And it has the powers of truth, and then it can forewarn of danger, and it also, if you're holding it, gives you anti-aging properties.
Hmm.
So that sword can be seen in the comics Day of Vengeance, Shadow Pact, and the Showcase issues.
Yeah, the if you want to go nor excuse me, if you want to know more information about the Shadow Pact, go to the video I did for DreadCentral.com depicting Ragman, who has shown up on Arrow this past season, and to learn a little bit about his involvement with that and all those supernatural beings of the DC universe before the Justice League Dark was formed.
Yeah, I think though that in this Constantine episode, it looks a little bit like the He-Man sword.
Yeah, a little bit. Also, after we meet Zach and his family, I thought the camera moved a lot like the Evil Dead.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the Evil Dead movies, the camera would move that
way. Kind of the backward shots type of thing.
Well, no, the way the camera would just kind of, like, move along or whatever and, like, really fast in the Evil Dead movies.
Oh, yeah, that. A little bit. I'd say so. You know, I think that it helps with the tricks that Henry, the newly possessed kid, is doing. You know, he has all these kind of force powers that he, you know, he force pushes things and he turns a turnstile carousel playground equipment.
Yes.
Yeah, so it has a bit of that. The name of the episode, Caliban, is actually from Shakespeare's The Tempest. And it's been used a lot, but Caliban is really, in our culture, because of Shakespeare, has this meaning of the person that has been oppressed to rise up against your oppressor. So the possessed kids are feeling oppressed in some way, and you kind of get that the first scene that you see with Henry, you know, the Omen kid, when his parents are fighting and his dad is just being dismissive of his fear of the dark.
Yeah, when he calls out about the boogeyman.
Yeah. Yeah, it's almost as if his dad doesn't really care about him, or if this is a stepdad, it seemed. The mother was all kind and loving, and the dad is like, just tough up, kid. When Constantine is actually trying to find some information about these things, he is met by a paralegal. I didn't catch her name, but she alludes to Constantine actually solving a previous case for her, like her husband's passing, Roger.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember in the episode what color hair she had, because there's multiple women in this episode. Claire is the mom, right?
Yes.
Okay, and who was the girl that Constantine was sleeping with?
Nora.
Okay, Nora. By the way, the woman who plays Nora, Eliza Dufour. Oh my god. She is a beautiful redhead. She's kind of a bit part character in many things, but look at her IMDb page, and she is just stunningly beautiful. That would probably leave Amy Parrish, I believe, who plays...
The character does have blonde hair.
Becca Schultz, I think, is the name of the paralegal.
Okay, yeah. So Constantine had alleviated her dead husband, Roger, from pissing and moaning that he's dead, according to him, and helped him to cross over. So she is now doing background checks and finding out semi-legally different information about these kids, and then gave him a lead on a Marcello Panetti, which lives in the asylum called Crestview Asylum. And his story, pretty sad, you know, his dad or whatnot was very cruel, and when he would get in trouble, he would chop off one of his fingers. So, yeah, that's pretty extreme.
Is this facility actually in use?
I do not believe so.
Okay. I couldn't find any information about it myself either.
This whole episode takes place in Birmingham, Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not, in my tentative view, find a Crestview Asylum in Birmingham.
The main focus point in this episode is being creepy kids being creepy, and the long history of media with creepy kids, like Village of the Damned, Children of the Corn. One of my favorite episodes of Supernatural, The Kids Are All Right. I think it's called The Good Child, starring Macaulay Culkin.
The Good Son,
yes.
Yeah.
One of the most offbeat, weird roles for Macaulay Culkin at the time, who was riding high on, like, Home Alone fame.
Yeah, but he did it really well.
Yeah. You know? I mean, God,
he played a creepy kid.
If he had done more of that, he might actually still have a career today.
Yeah, now he's just a creepy adult.
Yeah, he's just he's just kind of a mess like most childhood actors.
But he has a band.
Oh, he does?
He does.
Wow.
He has a band. The name of the band is called something like Leftover Pizza or something like that.
That sounds weird.
I'd have to do a quick Google here, but yeah, Macaulay Culkin's band.
Everyone should learn in the future to listen to John Constantine, because he's got the he tries to tell the teacher about what's going on. The teacher's more focused on, like, why is this guy, you know, watching a playground full of kids and not, like, just at least turning around once to see what's happening.
Yeah. So Macaulay Culkin's band name is called The Pizza Underground.
The Pizza Underground. Okay, we'll have to look that up.
I haven't listened to anything about it. I don't expect it to be good.
Okay.
It's Macaulay Culkin. To me, he's not a singer. So.
No, he's just the kid who screams a lot in the Home Alone movies.
And he was good in Party Monster.
I never saw that either.
That's a good one.
Hmm.
Okay, so when they visit Marcello Panetti, or Constantine visits Marcello Panetti at the asylum, the guy is catatonic. Just like, there is no one home. And one of the, according to the files that the paralegal gave him, one of the symptoms of it is that these kids start having violent outbursts just before the, you know, killings happen. So they're talking, John is talking with Chaz about the ley lines and how each of the addresses kind of follow the same ley line, and the kid is moving down this railroad of energy. And so I looked up the actual ley lines for Alabama. Birmingham is not really in the ley line. And I'm assuming that all the houses in this line were at least fairly close to Birmingham, because when the mother and John and Chaz travel to the first incident, the house, she says it was a lot longer drive than she was expecting, but they still got there within like an hour and a half, I think. The actual ley line that's in Alabama is called the Arcadian Ley Line, and that runs through Montgomery, Alabama, not Birmingham.
I wonder if they just play loosey-goosey with the map and everything for time constraints.
Probably, or just they had access to different locations. Ley lines are kind of the pseudoscience. I don't think that they're fairly legit. But the phrase was coined by an amateur archaeologist named Alfred Watkins. They're meant to power certain areas. What he did is he basically calculated out different places historically in the ancient world and modern times as to where people will naturally put things and the energies in which that they are honed to. If you were to do this with any sort of spread of buildings anywhere, you will find a statistical relevance regardless of if there is actually relevance. And so he used a mathematic blip basically to say, oh, these ley lines of energy. Yeah, and so you'll sometimes see, like, conspiracy theorists talk about, like, the ley lines with the pyramids and the different temples and things like that, when in fact they might be lined up more along the stars, and that's what they're really purposefully lined up with. But the ley lines, people will say, like, Santa Fe has a very strong ley line because a lot of people are of the New Agey persuasion are, you know, going to Santa Fe area. And really, that's more of, in my opinion, cause and effect. And like, statistically, like, someone says that this is a good place because it's beautiful and, you know, air is great and climate is nice and dry heat and whatnot. So people go there. And then because a lot of people of the New Agey type go there, then they say, oh, this must be powerful. That's kind of how Alfred Watkins did his assessments. And they've been debunked a lot of times, but we're using it in Constantine because it's a nice little plot device.
The I wanted to point out that the actress who plays Claire, she was in a TV series that just got canceled based on the Philip K. Dick story, also the Tom Cruise movie Minority Report. It was on Fox for only like 10 episodes.
What's the series?
Minority Report.
Oh, okay. I didn't even know they made a series of that.
Yeah, I remember hearing about it for like 5 seconds, and then it got canceled after 10 episodes. So maybe we'll cover it on the Dead TV podcast one day.
Maybe.
Maybe. It doesn't seem all that interesting.
Yeah, I think we'll have much more interesting shows to do.
That had only one season, yeah.
Before we dig in the bottom of the barrel there.
Yeah, that would definitely be maybe one of those one-offs or whatever. Maybe we'll come back to it with other actors who were on that show, you know?
Yeah.
But just doing some research on our main female character, I was just like, oh, look, she was on a series that got canceled.
Okay, so Henry, you know, force pushes the kid into the merry-go-round thing, and John sees this. The teacher is looking at him like he's a pedophile or whatnot, doesn't even see the injury and the fight between the two kids. The kid ends up getting a fractured skull. John poses as a school counselor in order to gain access to the kid and kind of test him. So the parents let him in, and he holds up a mandrake root, and the kid just like, ah, yeah. Mandrake root. Like, this episode doesn't have a lot of, like, super magical stuff. Yeah, this is very, very base magic. Very base. Like, I didn't have to do a lot of deep research into these. But mandrake root. The Anglo-Saxons considered mandrake root, as well as periwinkle, the definitive herbs for demonic possession. And so the mandrake root, what it does is that it has several different properties, some of which are properties that happen when you collect it. So in order for you to actually pull it from the ground, you needed to tie it with a string to a dog's leash and then have the dog pull it out of the ground because it is known to shriek when it's actually uprooted. I've seen mandrake roots. They don't do that. It's a superstition, but it's very well-known superstition. And it's also where in the Harry Potter series they have the kind of screaming baby, you know, plants and mandrakes come up. And so it's shown there. But the superstition was that if you pulled it yourself from the ground, then the shriek would actually drive a man insane. It is a hallucinogen and is also a poison. So do not, unless you know what the hell you're doing, eat it. I would choose psilocybin mushrooms before trying to, you know, get high on mandrake root.
Mandrake root seems to show up a lot in many fantasy role-playing games of darkness and things like that of various kinds to be used to create magical potions.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's a constant staple of magic.
Definitely. It's a staple. It's just one of those things like, oh, mandrake root, I'll just throw this in here in our D&D campaign. You know, it has a very lengthy history of magical properties, and to my knowledge, it doesn't really have any other medicinal properties except for a slight, like, it will cause you to, it will induce vomiting, stuff like that, but it's not really a useful herb other than magical for the most part.
When John,
on the other hand, like the Frankenstein, the frankincense,
yeah,
that he uses earlier in that episode in order to determine where the kid actually lives, you know, this is all taking place on Halloween, you know, and Halloween is the night where the veil is the thinnest and spiritual activities are at their highest for the year. So he's taking a frankincense incense and just kind of, with Chaz walking the town and seeing where it leads. In this episode, frankincense has the property of going away from, you know, bad spirits, away from bad energy. That's not its magical purpose. Classic frankincense. Like, frankincense is a very well-known, very ancient tree resin. And it's from the tree of the olibandum. Not sure if I'm pronouncing it correctly. But it's a tree resin. You know, it can be a shrub, tree, etc. But it's a resin. It was extremely popular in ancient world. Whole trade routes were built around transferring frankincense everywhere. That's because frankincense has a lot of uses. Not only is it an incense, but it is also a strong antiseptic. So it cleans the air that it's in. So churches and temples would actually use it because not only is it purifying the place that you're worshiping in, they also believe that frankincense would carry prayers to heaven. So the smoke would carry the prayers and everything would be good. And you've got a large gathering of people all in one place, especially in the ancient world, and you had nothing like antibiotics. So large gathering of people all in one place, diseases would spread. And frankincense would stop that. And so, therefore, it has also that magical properties of purification and the ability to have a lot of people in one place safely.
The when Manny visits John in jail and he leaves, he makes a comment that makes me believe that has Manny been John's guardian angel since he was a child, since his father was abusing him?
That's what is implied. Yeah. It's implied that he was his guardian angel, that he was there when his father would put cigarettes out on him, or he was there for him to prevent him from killing himself when his sister left. I don't know if that's his guardian angel, but he sure as hell implying as such.
The demon seems to feed on negative energy. Yeah, the demon seems to feed on negative energy, so when mom and dad get into a fight, it definitely starts to pick up on it and root out through the child more and more.
And Henry's trigger is the bickering between his mom and dad. So, you know, it's that, you know, stop fighting! Ah! And, you know, when you're a kid and your parents are fighting and on the brink of divorce, it seems like your world is falling apart. Yeah, you know, and kids sometimes have that "what did I do? Is there something I could have done?" type of guilt. Yeah, the guilt and the anger and things kind of spiraling out of their control, it feels like the end of the world. So, yeah, that's really difficult for kids. And I hate the couples that stay together, quote unquote, for the children, yet they're fighting all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's actually far more harmful than just divorcing and having your kids live between two different houses.
Yeah, that can definitely be extremely difficult. After the last temper tantrum by the child, Claire seeks out John, realizing she does believe him, and they need to fix this situation desperately so she can put her family back together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she sedates him and then goes find John. She finds John, goes back and sedates him, and then goes back to John, and they go to the house of the first incident to do a seance. Because they say they need three people for the seance. Yeah, and Zed is not there, so can't do it themselves.
Yeah, again, you're right about it being completely out of order, too. Also, since one of these episodes did air on Halloween night, this would have made more sense. What was NBC's explanation behind this? I'm not actually finding any reason why, as the show is canceled, and it wasn't exactly filled with, like, controversy or a lot of backstory, you know, like, they just canceled, like, the Tim Allen TV series Last Man Standing. And there's a whole bunch of information about Last Man Standing online. But the show's been on for 6 years when it got canceled. And even after it got canceled, the information is still coming in more and more about the different reasons why things were moved around the schedule or why this actress got, you know, left or whatever in the first season and got replaced in the second season. But things like this, when an episode is clearly about Halloween and they move it to, like, the middle of November after when it should have aired, which was on Halloween night, none of it makes any sense, and there's no explanation why other than stupid executive decisions by the network.
Yeah, when John gets punched in the face by the dad, you know, and I'm going to call it, that's the douchebag moment of the episode.
The dad punching John?
Yeah, the dad punching John.
Yeah, it seemed a little bit out of place there.
It does. It's like, John's not doing anything to your kid. You know, the mandrake root flew from his hand, and he's just saying that the kid is possessed. Saying something means you leave our house, not I'm going to punch you and put you in jail, because he didn't really do anything wrong. But, you know, so I would call that the douchebag moment of the episode for me. While he's in jail, John mentions, and this would make more sense if this were episode two, that he says 6 months in the loony bin and he's turned into an amateur. You know, it's like he's not an amateur because the last one you're putting the dead to rest with Papa Midnight. That line is also out of place.
By the way, I did actually now find some reasons why they moved the episode around, and it goes back to what you said earlier about Zed not being in the episode, and because the previous episode would have been the pilot, had Zed introduced at the very last minute, which was shoehorned in and filmed at the last minute because Zed was not supposed to be on the show right away due to the fact that the girl that John befriends in the first episode, the actress, the girl with the father that John was friends with,
Jasper Winter's daughter.
Yes, Jasper Winter's daughter was supposed to be a bigger character on the show, but the actress had to leave Constantine, but they had already filmed the pilot, and they could not refilm the pilot, so they put the Zed thing in there to help move along with what they were doing.
Yeah, that makes more sense. You know, if they had to shoehorn in Zed, then they had no place for this episode. And so they had to just kind of establish Zed as being part of the team and then give her an excuse or something to not be there, which they said art class. That was, you know, shoehorning other things to accommodate the new timeline.
Yeah. AV Club says, you can tell Rage of Caliban is going to be a good one from the last minute excuse for Angelica's absence. Zed's in art class all week, apparently, because John and Chas spend the run-up to Halloween in Birmingham, Alabama, figuring out how to exercise a young boy safely after what happened in Newcastle. Creator Daniel Carone writes and Neil Marshall directs, in case you needed any more proof, this was originally the second episode of Constantine, Why Sit on It, just to get the ball rolling on the post-live version of the show. Yes, Rage of Caliban sounded like a lost third season Star Trek about some neglected godlike alien, but it's actually a demon seed story that's about as good as a network demon seed story can be at this point.
Yeah, it's not a glowingly good episode. It was eh.
I was expecting a little bit more from it, but I mean, they do wrap the episode up with a nice little bow, and they send the demon into the body of a guy in the mental facility that we visited early in the episode, and the family lives happily ever after. No one dies, which is all very nice for everybody.
After that first incident with the girl Emily, no one else dies. Thing is resolved. The demon's not a demon. It's actually the soul of the first kid. And so then John tries to do a mirror spell to protect himself from it and ends up binding the soul back to its rightful place, which is in the body of the catatonic guy. and he's under protective custody. So yeah, it's tied up nice and neat. There's no real loose ends. There's not really a lot to say magically or plot line. It's pretty straightforward. It's like textbook Omen story.
I tried to see what the various kids were dressed like for Halloween, and there's only one in particular I caught walking behind John. Did you see him? He was dressed as Robin.
No, I didn't see that at all. That's good.
Yes, so they definitely probably went to the DC Comics prop department for all the casting extras for the kids and been like, oh, hey, we definitely need some DC comic characters. It would have been funny if he had run into three kids dressed as like Batman, Superman, and Wonder Woman. You know,
that'd
just
be
been like,
cool.
Oh, aren't you adorable, oh, buggish superheroes. You know, just some like sly comment about, you know, like he knows who these characters are.
Yeah, just another little Easter egg that we find.
Or, you know, maybe run into like some kid with a little bow and arrow and he's like, oh, hey, yeah,
hey,
you're
yeah,
my buddy Oliver.
Okay. One thing, though, that I'm kind of questioning, though, Chaz, when he holds the Sword of Night, when he holds it, he talks about why Renee left him.
Yes.
And Renee is, I guess his wife or, I guess, ex-wife now?
Yeah, well, I guess on the show it's his ex-wife, but in the comic books it was his wife. There's
his
a
wife,
self-contained
yeah.
graphic novel in which Chaz needs John's help to rescue their son, and Renee is, like, going out of her mind because of the fact that that Chaz called on John Constantine.
Mm-hmm.
And John is the only one who can save their son.
Because, you know, John's a badass.
John's a badass. But it's a very much John-like look for Ryan, the actor who plays him, at the very end of the episode when he's sitting on the truck.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, very, very, very John Constantine-ish pose. Very John Constantine picture image.
Yeah, and he actually puts the cigarette in his mouth and lights it.
Mm.
Doesn't take a drag, but he lights that cigarette.
Which, again, I think we clarified in the last episode that he is allowed to take a drag. Sorry, he's allowed to put it in his mouth, but he is not to take a drag.
Yeah, the stance on anti-smoking. Yeah, but you see little bits of it around, like when he's at the bar with the paralegal, like there is an ashtray with some butts, you know, stomped out in it. You know, so it does give that feeling that he is a smoker. I like that. I don't care that he's actually not physically smoking. That's fine. Another thing about Chaz, though, is that we find out more about him in the quid pro quo episode, which is coming up. But one of the questions I have in this episode is, he doesn't die in this episode, but he does get pinned between two cars to the point where you can actually hear the bones crunching. And I'm wondering if his healing power is just because, like, he dies and he has those souls bound to him and he comes back to life, or does he heal from everything even if he doesn't die? Because you could really hear that crunch when he gets pinned. He just says, oh, go, I'm fine, go. But, dude, that would take a long time to heal if he didn't have a healing power.
Oh, yeah. I saw that, too, and I was just like, well, he'll get out of that perfectly fine because he's got that thing that John did to him.
Yeah, yeah, the enchant spell.
Yeah, which allows him to keep on living.
Yeah, so he has, I think it's 47 souls bound to him that he's used up quite a few now. But yeah,
I guess maybe he's got unlimited. Maybe he's got more. I don't know. I mean, the show only has like one season, so I don't know if they, you know, I don't remember if in the later episodes we get around that little hiccup.
Well, we do actually talk. One of the episodes, I think it's Quid Pro Quo, actually explains his healing power, and he goes into the depths of the details as to how many souls he's got left. So he's got a limited amount of lives because they're kind of borrowed from other people. But, you know, the episode with the ghosts, what is it? Yeah, the dance voodoo.
Mm-hmm.
Chaz is killed by that model ghost a number of times.
Yeah, that's right. The one with the messed up face.
Yeah, and stabs with the scissors. He's stabbed a number of times, and he only has like a certain set number of lives. So I think he hopefully is keeping count, and I know we find out a a little bit more detail on that in another episode.
Well, in the next episode of our podcast, we're going to have our first guest on for the podcast that's actually connected to a show that we're covering. Blessed Are the Damned, we will have on with us actress Megan West, who plays the character Imogen, one of the main characters for the episode.
Yes, and she'll be with us the whole episode, right?
I believe so. I just sent a tweet out to just to say in 2 weeks we have Megan West on the show with us, who's also in a movie that I had her director on for on the Radio of Horror show called The Eyes. So she'll be doing a little bit of plug of that, but she will be sitting with us for the episode of the Dead TV podcast, and we'll figure out the details about if she's on for the whole episode, or we'll probably start talking with her once we get to the plot line where her revolves around her character. Yes. So our first guest from a TV series that we're actually covering. Hopefully we'll have more. Obviously with Friday the 13th, we'll have a little bit longer time to try and get somebody on from that show.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of those actors, of course, will be now in their 50s or so when that show first aired back in the late 80s. So, because a lot of those actors were in their 20s, 30s, or 40s who were on the show as either guests or, you know, recurring characters. So,
well, you know, if I did a show, you know, if I was that age, did a show 20, 30 years back, and someone called me about that role, as long as I had good memories associated with that role and it wasn't like, you know, Christian Bale's refusal to acknowledge Newsies because he was so gypped on that deal.
Yeah.
I would totally come on the show. You know, I wouldn't care if it's a podcast or radio. Someone wants to talk to me about one of my roles? Sure.
That happened with one of the first actors I ever had on for Radio of Horror. When I started Radio of Horror 10 years ago, back in 2007, I reached out. I was on my way to work. And I reached out to have on the show the star of the USA Network TV series from the 80s or 90s called Werewolf the Series. Did you ever see this?
No.
It lasted for like 32 episodes. It only lasted for like one or two seasons. The actor who ended up coming on actually has a recurring role on One Life to Live. And he told me that when he got the call from his agent that some guy wants to interview you in Massachusetts about Werewolf the Series. Do you know what he's talking about? He was like, what? He told me that in the interview. He's like, he doesn't want to interview me for one, like, General Hospital. He plays Max Scorpio on General Hospital.
Oh, okay.
Mike Scorpio. Mike Scorpio, I think his name is, on General Hospital.
So people were always probably wanting him to talk about General Hospital.
Yeah, so when he gets a phone call about Werewolf the Series, which is like the first thing he ever did, you know, that was like one of his first roles. And then when it got canceled, he did a couple of things, and then he got the role on John J. York. That's who I had on the show. He was so happy. He was just like, wow. Because he's been on General Hospital since like the mid-90s. So his career is mostly tied to that, and All My Children as well. But John J. York was the actor I had on. Very, very nice guy. Has appeared in over 546 episodes of General Hospital. So a long, long career. But I wanted him on for Werewolf the Series. Which at the time, Horror Hound had just put out an article saying that Shout Factory was putting the series out on DVD for the first time. The problem is it got canceled immediately right after that announcement because they couldn't get the rights to the music in the show. And to this day, Werewolf the Series is still not available on DVD or Blu-ray in the United States.
Damn it.
And it is a good show. Like, it is a show we should cover one day because it's that good. I mean, the special effects on this show were like practical werewolf effects.
I mean, I still have a VHS player, so, you know, there's certain things I can't get in the United States on DVD.
And that's it for this episode of the Dead TV Podcast. If you'd like to listen to it and more of our episodes, go to RadioHard.com. You can also catch us on our Facebook page at the Dead TV Podcast, or catch us on our individual Twitters at ChrisDSAV.
And at Elegantly Kinky.
Thank you, Mr. Zeneca, for joining me for this episode, and we'll be back in 2 weeks. Have a good night.
Good night. All right. Bye.